My guest today is Catherine Fraze, the founder of Workspace Education and the educational R&D company 100 Roads. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Oh, thanks, Blake. I'm so happy to be here.
This has been a long time coming. I've known about you for many years and about Workspace in Connecticut for many years. Mm-hmm. And I know that that has evolved recently as of the pandemic. And so it sounds like we have a lot of ground to cover here.
Yes. Well, yeah, certainly pandemic has brought a lot, thrown a few spanners in the works, and it's really helped us actually move the needle on what I think is the future of education. So I'm excited to share about that.
Oh, excellent. So let's start with the obvious. You are from Australia.
Yes. Born and raised in Perth, and near Scarborough Beach for anyone else who's listening from Australia. A little surfy. I had my little foamy. But I discovered in high school that I felt very, very stuck. And I decided right back then that I wanted to spend my life in education and trying to create alternative environments for students. So
you realized that in high school?
Yeah, in high school.
How did you learn that? What was the moment?
Actually, the moment was, I think, when I was about 9. And I was in, we call it primary school, elementary school in America. And we had to do this test. And if you're in the top 35%, you got to do a foreign language. And I wasn't in the top 35%. So I'm like, oh, well, I guess I won't be able to do a foreign language, right? And I talked to my parents about that. And they said, you know, if you really want to do something, just go and do it. Just go and state your case and make them argue why you can't do it. Mm. Right. So that sort of gave me a little fortification. And I went up to the headmaster of the school and I said, look, I really want to do German. I don't really know why I wanted to do German. It was just the only language that was available. I think I should be allowed to do it. I think it's unfair that, you know, I think I'm smart enough to do it. And I don't know what happened on the test, but, you know, I really want to do that class. So I was allowed to do it. And I enjoyed the class. And from that point on, I remember distinctly thinking that, well, I can do anything I put my mind to. I'm not going to be stuck in a system or be beholden by the system. Hmm. So since that moment, there's been this little voice in my head that's like, you know, when anyone says they can't do something, you know, I'm like, okay, let's find the workaround. What is the workaround? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that has taken me as having that as part of my little life ethos, I suppose, has allowed me to do some extraordinary things in my life. And I want to give everyone else that agency.
I saw online that you are trained as a Montessori teacher. And did you work in a Montessori mm-hmm. school? Did you work in conventional schools? What's your education background?
Yeah, so I went into teaching because I wanted to obviously reform teaching. And I was actually teaching Japanese. I also learned Japanese in high school and decided I went to Japan when I was 12. I chose the school because I really wanted to go on this Japanese trip, which was awesome. And I met the Emperor of Japan and the president.
Emperor of Japan?
I did. Well, actually,
at age 12?
He wasn't the Emperor. Yes, he wasn't the Emperor then. He was the Emperor's son, but he became the Emperor. So I feel like I'm justified in saying that story. Yes. You know, it was an amazing trip. And I learned a lot about humans on that trip because, you know, I'm meeting all these people, I'm staying with families. And I just assumed before then that everyone thought the same about everything, you know, about, you know, you're in the same situation, you'd have the same feelings and thoughts in your mind about what's going on. But I really discovered that, you know, people can be in exactly the same situation and think so differently. So it gave me this appreciation of humans and how different and diverse.
Can you give me an example of how you learned that in Japan or elsewhere?
There
are different cultures that exist moment.
There were 6 people at the school that I was billeted Australian word for staying with families and going to a school that specialized in manga comic making. So you remember the little manga comics?
Yeah, like graphic novel style.
Yeah, it was amazing. Anyway, I was in this school that specialized in that, and there were 6 of us, and I was by far the youngest at 12. I just got onto the trip. I was just just finished 8th grade, or I was around that age. And everybody else in the school was going to the Ginza, which is like this big shopping center. It's like in the heart of Tokyo. It's millions of people and amazing shops. And I just sort of, you know, I'm thinking, okay, well, this is, everyone else is going that I know that's Australian, that's on the, sort of in this group. So I'm going to go too. So I went and I, you know, I'm there and I'm with all these other people. And then they're all going home at the end of this sort of this trip to this shopping center or the this. I mean, we had to catch trains there. It was really quite far. We're talking, you know, at least 45-minute trip in there. And I wasn't getting picked up. Like, I wasn't picked up. Like, my host family had no idea I was actually there. And everybody else left. And I'm by myself in the middle of the Ginza. And I'm talking to, you know, this lady, and I'm trying to explain. I didn't have much Japanese. I'd only really just started learning it then. And she's like, well, just stand on this chair. Like, I'm and because you're so different, because you're Australian and you're different, they're going to come and find you. So I'm standing on this chair in the middle of this place. And then no one's coming to pick me up. And then, well, I'm trying to explain to them that, you know, I need to find these people. And I got my diary out, and they called the family, and the family had no idea. And they were really embarrassed that they had lost their exchange student. And, you know, I had to wait there at the shop until they had come. So about an hour and a half at the shop. And on the way back, no one would talk to me. Like, it was a really, They were embarrassed. I brought shame on the family. Everyone around me were all wearing masks. I mean, obviously that's normal now, but I guess it was peak hour, and everyone wears masks in Japan on the way home. And I'm just thinking, this is such an odd place and no one's communicating. And it was just a really different way of thinking. And because I didn't have the language skills, I guess because I didn't speak Japanese very well and I didn't really understand the nuances as well. And just the way that they were explaining things, it was like a sleuth to really try and get between the lines and understand the culture.
So other people in this situation might have considered this like a traumatic event. Like, what do you think gave you the fortitude to kind of see this as a learning experience or a cultural experience?
You know, well, I think the honest truth was that as a little tacker, I had a very bad lisp, like a speaking difficulty. I guess I must have sucked my thumb for too long or something. I felt very, very self-conscious about that. And I think I spent, you know, a fair bit of time on my own and trying to work out how to navigate the social situations at school. And I think that they can be, you know, they were mean. Well, I had some mean kids in my, you know, grade one. And they were there in grade two, and they were there in grade three, and they were there in grade four. And I was, you know, the cumulative effect of having to deal with the same bullies or the same situations, and you're just trying to work it out. Like, how do I need to function? And in Australia, the culture is like, you know, if you don't struggle, you know, struggling is all part of the deal of being a human, you know, that's how you're going to learn how to cope with these things. And I think, you know, to some degree, it made me very resilient and able to know that I was going to be okay and pretty independent. But on the other hand, I think there's social scarring. There was something that really got to the core of me feeling lovable as a little child that took a long time to get over. Like, I feel like I was scarred by that school experience in the sense that I, over and over and over and over, I was having to justify myself and I don't know, make, I'm not a psychologist, but I feel like it feels right that it, you know, I was hurt in school and I was harmed by it.
Do you think that fed into your decision to want to become an educator? Like, you wanted to do better?
Well, it fed into this thing. Like, I remember when I was teaching and I would see, okay, that kid's being picked on, or this kid has got this behavior or this coping mechanism, or I could see things in kids that I had experienced, like not just feeling nervous to be outside at recess because somebody might have taken my backpack, or like just like stupid, you know, school mean girl, mean boy, I don't know, mean kid stuff, right? You know, then I just, you know, I really, you know, I really wouldn't put up with it as an adult. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like we, you know, as an adult, you can walk away from these experiences, mm-hmm. right? But so, you know, like in a prison situation, you can't. And I see school more like a like, is this the best we can do for these kids?
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah, you're not even allowed to opt out of these, you know, sometimes very harmful social situations.
Right. I mean, that's just one of the things, you know, you know, I honestly believe like I had to go back to Montessori and I, you know, I got 3 Montessori certifications because I wanted to re-educate myself. Hmm. And the reason that I found my education so bad was because I think what they teach it all in little tiny fragments rather than giving you the whole, the big picture first, and then you can fit everything back into the big picture of what you're trying to do.
Are you talking about teacher training in Australia now?
No, I'm talking about school.
School, period. Learning like, as a student, yeah.
I left college. I did Islamic fundamentalism in Egypt as my thesis in political science, right? And I'd never been to Egypt, right? I don't know if I'd ever met a Muslim person in Australia. I probably did, I just didn't know, right? And here I am, you know, I'm reading like foreign affairs and all these, you know, different political journals and different journals, and I'm forming my opinion based on other people's opinions about something that they've written about, which they may or may not have even gone to, right? And they, you know, like I'm writing about the Muslim Brotherhood. I've never been to Egypt. Like, to me, that's so abstract. And I'm writing this 50,000-word thesis, which is going to be published. And it's embarrassing. Like, it's not my learned experience. Like, it's not real. So I was like, okay, look, I didn't know what Western civilization was when I left college. I mean, that is scary.
I had a similar experience when I wrote my senior thesis, which I think had to be 50,000 words. And it was about Sudbury schools and sort of the philosophy of self-directed learning. And I folded some other stuff in there that I'm kind of embarrassed to even talk about now. But I think the only practical experience I had was volunteering at this one Sudbury school near San Francisco for, I don't know, maybe a total of 20 hours. And otherwise, it was just synthesizing a bunch of other people's ideas. And so I think I vibe with what you're saying about feeling like a bit like an intellectual imposter.
Yeah. It needs to be more real, more applied. I want to learn something and then do it. And then be like, yeah, this is a good way. I'm going to keep going there and build up on that.
So let's talk about your Montessori experience, because I think that's what a lot of people think Montessori is. It's a lot of learning by doing. It's a lot of age mixing. I think everyone imagines the kids in Montessori preschool playing with these wooden manipulative toys. Mm-hmm. And tell me what your experience was like.
So I did Montessori as my children grew up. So I did, 3 to 6, and then I did my 6 to 12. I did my master's in Montessori with the top math. I'm Montessorian in the country, which was incredible. And then I did my adolescent training. So obviously I really, I jive with the philosophy, but what I loved about it most of all is that the learning is discovered. It's not like we're going to teach you to read. You get a sort of a game or they call them materialized abstractions of a concept. So you get, so everything in the classroom has a purpose, multiple purposes actually, and the kids are playing with them, but they're actually doing a lot of other things that they just don't realize they're doing at the same time. And you learn math and you learn language in tiny little bite-sized nuggets. They're like lily pads, little lily pads of knowledge, and they're spaced out. So you'll learn that. The little activity, and you're applying it as you're learning it, and you're sort of experiencing it, and you're linking it to everything else, and you're observing everything else that's going on in the room. And then you kind of master that, and you're ready for the next one. You get shown how to do that very, very quickly with no spoken language. It's just they show you how to do it, and then the kids basically mimic, like they can just observe and watch, and then they can do it. And then they basically experience that next bit of learning, and then they start making connections with what they learned before, and they build their knowledge as they go.
Well, this sounds great. You found the promised land. Why aren't you still a Montessori teacher?
So I think that Montessori is not for everyone. And so this is my whole thing with Workspace, is that humans are so diverse, right? Like, it just, I had two, and I have one that's very much would have been fine in traditional, using a classical methodology, or, you know, very book oriented with story, a lot of story. She was fine in Montessori for a while anyway, because she was fine with she had great fine motor skills, and she liked all the beads, and she liked the manipulatives and those sort of things. And then I had a son who was much more ADHD, really into gross motor, highly active, wanted to climb everything, couldn't stay with something for more than like 5 seconds, and was a bit of a terror in the classroom. So, that really was not a great pedagogy for him, right? Because he was just disrupting everybody. But, you know, I've seen it work incredibly well for some. So there's no one size fits all perfect pedagogy. And then I also see how, you know, my son at the beginning was pretty, I mean, I was never diagnosed him, of course, but he was, you know,
he passed the sniff test for ADHD.
The sniff test, he definitely would have done that. But like, you know, when he was 12, he was really the opposite. It was very, very calm. So, you know, like maybe it was sensory, or whatever it was, he just took a while to unwind into himself, if that makes sense. And, you know, he needed a different pet. I mean, I think he would have been fine in Montessori. I did try him back when he was 12 into Montessori, and we didn't last a full year. Well, we just last a full year. I pulled him out, and he would have, he had quite a lot of, I don't want to talk about my son really, but he had quite a lot of anxiety, and he was just much better off at home. He was really enjoying being at home. I just thought it was time for him to have more kids around.
Was your family in the United States by this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Connecticut. Yes, I had my children in Connecticut. I met my husband on a world trip.
He was also traveling?
No, well, he lived in Manhattan, and I took a year off teaching Japanese because the union was on strike, and I had a problem because my Japanese wasn't great, and I was doing a lot of extracurricular activities, and they were banning all of those. So I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? You know, we couldn't go to karaoke, and we couldn't make sushi, and we couldn't do all these things that I really, really like to do. So I thought I'd go around the world, and I was teaching skydiving on the weekends, and and I wanted to go and visit alternative schools, because my favorite professor at college when I did my teacher training, she was really into this educator, Krishnamurti, who's all about conditioning. He talks about conditioning and how we're conditioned to think in a certain way, and we're really pretty much on automatic most of the time, and it's how to stay awake, how to be actually in control of your mind. And there are actually Krishnamurti schools around, so I wanted to go visit them. So I did this big trip and met my husband in New York.
At one of these schools?
No, actually at the drop zone at this.
That's what I wanted you to say. I was like, please tell me you met your husband skydiving.
At the Blue Sky Ranch near New York.
He was a client? You were the instructor?
Yeah, it was Memorial Day, yes. I had just arrived the week before, and I went to the pub and I said, I need a job for the summer. And so I was living in a tent next to this little airstrip in New Paltz in Gardner, New York. And he had just done 7 jumps, his accelerated free-fall training, and wanted a coach for the season. And
you each got more than you bargained for. Yeah.
Yeah. And we fell. We like to say we fell in love. But,
oh my gosh. All yeah. Right, let's scoot right past that one. Great. So tell me about your transition into Workspace. And maybe you can just start by briefly telling people who have no familiarity with it what Workspace Connecticut was or is, and then what led you to it.
Sure. Okay. So so what I was doing at the time of around Workspace was I just put my son into Montessori school. So I'm a mum, I'm homeschooling. I've been homeschooling for about 10 years. I'm one of those mums who likes to organize things. So I was doing Destination Imagination and Lego League and all these things. And I had started this little project called 2HP, which was our Huckleberry Hill project. And it was about the kids coming over for one day a week, and they would spend the morning deep diving into a passion, and then trying to work out how they can put what they were really loving out into the community somehow. So my daughter was starting Lucky Tales Animal Rescue. She was 13 and she ended up doing that for 2 years, starting a nonprofit and importing 20 dogs from Georgia and working at a vet and all sorts of different things. And my son, who was 9, was really into Minecraft. It had just come out, and he was building the library in Minecraft. And then he went to the library and got them to start a server for 3 different towns. And he basically launched a Minecraft club that went for more than 5 years, every Saturday from 10 to 12. Yeah. Anyway, so that was Huckleberry Hill Project. And I just saw that during those years where the kids were actually doing real world stuff in something that they loved, the growth was unbelievable. Like the growth in them, their confidence, their agency, their like, if I can do that, I can do anything, you know, like, you know, like from that moment when my daughter did the animal rescue, and then she started writing a book. She got a book published when she was 16. She's just about to publish her third book, and she's 22, just left college, Tufts. All of these things, like when I asked her, you know, what in her education was the thing that really, what she really learned in that. And she always says things like, it was that I just felt I could do anything, that I was never held back by that. But that gave her a lot of confidence.
This was your family homeschooling that she was describing.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. I'm supposed to get to workspace. Yes.
So well, it sounds like you had a very successful homeschooling situation. So now I'm even more curious, if this was working so well, why spend time creating anything else?
Yeah. So with my son, so my daughter's gone to college. It's me and my son. And he has a little anxiety. He's probably a little ADHD brain. So what I would say with that is that computer games are very soothing to a young human like that. And they can become a little addictive because it's just what their brain likes to do a lot. And it's also, when you have anxiety, it's a really good way to, you know, to connect with friends without it being too, too challenging in that department too. So I was like, okay. I did try and put him in school, and he had panic attacks in the basement of the school. So I'm like, okay, if I had to create the perfect environment for this kid, so he could create the best life he could possibly can in a space, what would that look like? So that's what workspace is. It's a space where I could actually be as a parent in the space, and I can have my own life going on, and he can have his own life going on, and he's surrounded by inspiring people, and we've got all sorts of different classes and courses. We had 140 classes and courses on the schedule. And I just got, you know, I had this building that I could use, 32,000 square feet. And I thought, okay, I'm going to set it up for authentic creative self-expression, which is, you know, how humans put themselves out there. So we had like an art studio. We had this amazing science lab and scientist who was incubating scientists, you know, a place we called Global Awareness for Humanities. We had a dance floor, wood shop. It's like a computer tech, laser printing, 3D printing kind of lab, a big black box theater, audio recording, cardboard manufacturing. We had giant co-working space. Then we had the upstairs conference center so they could do their TED Talks and all that kind of stuff. So we just had, we had about 30 different learning areas for all these classes and courses, and it just became this big zoo of activity.
So I have so many questions at this point, but I think I'll start with the elephant in the room, I'm sure. Like when a lot of people learn about the Sudbury Valley School, they say, well, that's brilliant. I'm glad they have all these different spaces and it's a beautiful campus, but how do you get a place like that? Did you just have, I remember hearing that workspace was some sort of, you know, $2 or $3 million building. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, how did you get access? How did you get access to this?
Yeah. So I looked at about 40 different sort of landscapes. So when I did my adolescent training in Montessori, I was immersed in this forest, 55-acre forest in Australia for a month. And we had to envision this landscape, what it looked like. And I was thinking, well, I want these kids to be around makers and doers and, you know, inventors. But in Montessori, they talk a lot about being on a farm and in the early adolescent years. So I was looking at every farms, and I found this amazing farm, but it was $8 million. And I found an old wood mill, and that was a beautiful landscape, but it, you know, it was, you know, even it was going to cost $3 million before you even walked in, because I had to move, you know, a lot of infrastructure. And then this wire, I found this incredible wire mill, which is why Workspace has like the logo of Workspace had like wire, a wire mesh font, because we in Connecticut invented the wire mesh at this wire mill. And it was an incredible facility, but it was under litigation, and there was a lot of, there was still some brown soil in there. So it's still under litigation. Like, I would never have gotten this place, but I thought this would be the most perfect place for urban renewal for teenagers. And I could bring in the local governments. We could do all these amazing real world projects in there. And then I went into this business park, and I found this this building, Cannondale Bicycles. I don't know if you know Cannondale mm-hmm. Bicycles. They invented the aluminium frame, and they had their headquarters there in this building. They built this beautiful big red barn. And then it had this industrial building behind it, and it's on a lake, and it's next to 650 acres of forest. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is like so perfect. Like, I'm walking through it, and my body is like bouncing up and down, because I could just see everything already done, you know, including we had this amazing industrial kitchen in the middle and a cafe. And it was just an incredible, I just knew I'd already done it in my head walking through this building. So I said to my husband that, you know, it's Mother's Day, and
it's Mother's Day, and, hubby. Could you
and
please?
And our son needs a place, right, to do his education. And, you know, this is exactly what the world needs. The world needs to see this. And I can make a really bold example of what good looks like. And I'm, you know, I'm probably the only one crazy enough to attempt this, but I'm sure I'm not. I'm sure there are others. But at the time, most people were thinking I was crazy to just buy this building and turn it into this. But we need places like this in the world.
Well, I agree. I still want to know, how did you finance it? Were you guys in a position to just purchase this?
He started a company the day that my son was born. He's now 18. And he managed to sell 70% of it. And he said that I could have my part of the proceeds to do what I wanted with.
Cool. Okay. So
I thought, I'm going to revolutionize education. Yes. You know, like.
Okay. So a fortuitous sale from your husband's company enabled you guys to.
That's right.
To take this building on.
And then I didn't get it interior decorated. I called Sherman Williams, and I picked 5 paint colors, and, you know, I made wallpaper, and, you know, we did the best we could on a shoestring, you know.
So there's another thing that stood out to me when you were listing off the characteristics of Workspace, which is that, you know, this is not like, I keep coming back to the Sudbury Valley School, just because there's not that many like big properties like this out there where these sorts of self-directed models are being practiced. But Sudbury Valley School is very clear. This is a space for our students and our staff, not for parents. And you said, this is like a co-working, co-learning space where parents, you said you wanted to be around your son during the day. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is unique because you're starting this program for your son, but also for other people's kids. Mm-hmm. But did you have other parents coming and working in the workspace while their kids were attending? Was that the model?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah, the model is like, it's just as good as for parents as it is for the kids. I mean, like, seriously, when you are homeschooling, like when I was homeschooling, I wanted to talk to adults because I wasn't at work, and I love being at work and love being talking about things in my passion with other adults. And so I wanted to go and have other people to do things with. And so did a lot of the parents. Like, we had a parent that started a Shakespeare troupe, and it was incredible, and had parents and had educators and the kids, and everybody was involved in all sorts of different things.
And what are these parents doing for work? Are these parents who have remote jobs or work for themselves or have otherwise flexible arrangements?
Yeah. And I think, you know, during COVID, that's probably exacerbated that availability. But, you know, we'd have like parents who would like, well, first of all, no one wants to be in one place 5 days a week. I mean,
amen.
You know, we think, because we're replicating school in our mind, that we need to be in a place for 5 days a week. But like in reality, most homeschoolers wouldn't want to go to a place more than 2 or 3 times a week. Mm. That's probably enough social, right, for the family. And, mm-hmm. you know, kids, when they're doing their personalized pathways, they need time where they can really focus and concentrate, right? And other times where they're going to be creative and want to do projects and do all sorts of different things. And different kids will need a different balance of that. So the beauty of a place like Workspace is you can come in and you can attend what you want to attend, and you come in and the family's in charge of what, you know, of their children's schedules are. And, you know, maybe, you know, some of the families, you find your people inside that, because when you have enough families, you know, you find other families, it's like you date families. You find the right mix of families and then you organize stuff with them and the kids get on, and then you got this great kitchen, and then oh, this is amazing woodworking person, and then this is chef, and maybe we can combine those two. Why don't we make picnic tables and then have a crazy event out in the back parking lot and do this? And yeah. maybe this group over there can perform for us, you know, like it's the ability to like to all have these collisions, these fortuitous collisions, you know, in the halls and in the hub at Workspace, mm-hmm. and come up with these imaginative things. Like we were doing an Alice in Wonderland day where we're all like, you know, we were all getting costumes, and we had flamingo croquet, and we had all sorts of things all happening around the building. And that whole session, we were talking about, like in everybody's classes, they were doing little Alice in Wonderland tributes. So like, you know, they'd be like, hey, we're going to make haiku and it's going to be Alice in Wonderland inspired, or we're going to be doing this, or we're going to be doing that. And we can like, as a whole community, do stuff, not just the kids yeah. doing projects. It's like we could do stuff as a community, as families, as individuals, as, you know, like two kids as study buddies could, you know, do some competition.
Yeah. No, it's
like we're not limited.
It's an extremely beautiful vision. I have a few more sort of like logistical questions for you that are mm-hmm. popping up in my head. So this is located in Bethel, Connecticut. What mm-hmm. what part of Connecticut is that? And how did you draw families in? Because I feel like you have to be near some high population density areas in order to have
you
families
do, really.
Come in.
It is a lot harder, unless you want to spend a ton of money on marketing. But, you know, we did have people that would drive a long way. That the our
what's the closest city? What's the closest big city that I would recognize to Bethel?
Well, Danbury. We have Hartford, the capital, and we have New York City, and we're right in between that. And we're right in the outskirts of Danbury, okay. And that's a city, but not a very big one.
Okay, so you're also kind of near New Haven.
New Haven's on the coast. We're sort of inland.
Okay. But did you have families who would drive from New York City and from Hartford?
We had a family that drove from the other side of JFK. So that would take them 2.5 hours, sometimes 3 with traffic. And they had, you know, a bunch of kids. And they could only do it for about 6 weeks. And then they're like, And I would complain after like 30 minutes of driving.
Yeah.
You know, I wished, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so excited about what we're doing now is that you don't need to drive.
Yes,
like you can get the full experience of Workspace. Actually, I can do 10 times the stuff, the value, right, for a tenth of the cost in the format that I'm doing it now. So now it's widely available and much cheaper. So you can just try it.
Yeah, and we're gonna get there to Workspace Sky in a second. Here's another question for you about Workspace Connecticut.
Okay.
So this model where did you call them students? Did you call them something else? What was your word for the kids?
Well, you know, if we had to call them learners or something like that, we'd use learners, but you know, we didn't like to differentiate. Like, well, they're just younger people, aren't they?
Okay. Okay. So the younger learners, if they're coming with their parents, does this mean mm-hmm. that in terms of the responsibility to supervise mm-hmm. kids, was that delegated to the parents, or did you have a team of staff and those staff could have the responsibility of oversight so that families could drop their kids off and not stick around if they wanted to?
Yeah. So like this is the question, right? Like, so because we had a building, right? I mean, a big building with lots of exits. And because we had things like wood shops with saws and equipment and soldering and, you know, we had cutting knives from the, you know, we're doing a lot of cardboard work and all sorts of things. And also that we couldn't predict kids, like, you know, like if you have a child that's not doing very well at school and he might be, you're like, okay, well, no one likes him at school. The teachers don't like him. I'm going to pull him out because it's, and then they're looking for things to do and they'd be very, very happy to just drop their child off. And we don't really have that history of the child. And we have a lot of dangerous stuff. And we have a lot of people who are actually working in classes and there could be a lot of rambunctious. I mean, that it's like, it's, they have complete freedom. Mm. And when you come out of a pretty authoritarian environment like a school, it takes time to really find yourself and that self-discovery and being confident in who you are and how you behave and how you're interacting with people. And so in that de-schooling or that transition stage, you know, I think the children really need guidance, and I think their parents really need to see the impact that their child is having on the people around them as well. So for me, I feel like the child needs their parent, especially when they're younger. And when we feel really confident that they're going to be fine and they're not going to be disruptive and they're going to, you know, they're going to easily be able to attend people's classes without, you know, being disruptive or disrespectful of the person trying to do the course and those sort of things, then we're a lot more relaxed about the supervision. But that is something that has to be kind of, you don't know from an interview process, you know, what that's going to be like. And the parents say a lot of things in the interview and don't necessarily do that in real life. And what actually tends to happen is that the parents will come and they will sit in the hub, right? Like in the, like a library, like in the center, and their kids will be running around anyway and finding their friends and playing and, you know, playing chess and then going to this class and that class and then just checking in with their parent. But like if their child left, but let's say they left an exit and they're walking down the street, we didn't have enough staff to make sure that we could, you know, we weren't guarding the exits and we wanted it to be a free environment. So the only way we could make it free, like free mentally and not being on top of the kids, was to have somebody else who was responsible.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so it sounds like if a family was there for a while, maybe as you could think of it as a trial period, and the kid proved themselves to be very responsible, then it could be an option for the kid to come without the parents. But there had to be that getting to know you period.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had to be signed out to someone. Like you couldn't, there was nobody at Workspace who didn't have a guardian of some description. So if you couldn't be with your child and you'd organized with this family to take care of your child, you could do that. If they were with a background educator and they're going to be with that educator for 3 hours, you don't have to be there, right? But if your child is at large and they can go in and out of the woodshop and leave the building and go and play basketball and hanging out with these, you know, these teens, right? Like if we don't want the situation where a parent comes back and say, hey, my kid was heard this word because they were hanging out with this guy and they were doing rap in the audio recording and, you know, and I'm not okay that he learned that word. We'll be like, well, you should have been supervised, right?
Yeah. So every kid, student, learner needs to be associated with some adult who is their guardian. It could be some other kid's parent. It could be temporarily an educator.
Yeah. Who's there. Well, I mean, we didn't have the budget.
How many staff did you have in addition to yourself?
Well, we had. Well, that varied depending on the programming that we were doing. But we had a dream director who's basically our school psychologist, who really got to know the learners, and also was her role really was to launch them into what they wanted to do and to help them navigate, you know, whatever pathway that they wanted to be following. We had a curriculum specialist who was part-time. We had a front desk person for when people came in the building. We had a full-time scientist. We have a full-time facility director that's for leaks and, you know, everything that can happen with the building. Mm-hmm. We had our tech wizard, a tech specialist who was in our tech area, who would help with all tech issues. So if you were doing a class and you couldn't get the projector to work, he could run up and help you with that. And give you a tutorial on that. But as far as supervising, I mean, we had two people who ran the kitchen, two amazing chefs who would be there. They ran their own business in there, so they weren't really officially staff. And I had an admin person who was doing all the, you know, the membership.
So that's about eight people, I think.
Yeah.
And how many, what was your capacity? Or let's say instead, what was the maximum number of families and how many people was that? Was that usually one parent and one kid?
We did actually have a high percentage of only children. You know, obviously they're probably looking more for community. And also I think the more children you have, the more exponentially complicated it is to do scheduling and those sort of things.
Yes.
So, you know, I wanted to have, you know, about 150 families. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking the Dunbar number. How many people can you really get to know in that building? We could have had up to 600 humans in that building, but that's what it was designed for. But I was thinking, you know, I had a break-even number with about 150 families.
And did you achieve that number?
We were on the right. We're going before COVID. We were on the right track. We were heading in the right direction. But
I feel like this story is about to turn into a tragedy, Catherine.
It is. It's not. It's actually turning into.
Well,
it's pivoting slightly.
Yes, a momentary tragedy followed by a phoenix from the ashes.
It was a tragedy for some, but it was a gentle tragedy. It was a gentle unfolding of the tragedy.
So
it's not really. It's not a tragedy at all.
Just for so we have some landmarks. When did Landmark open, and how long did it run until?
Yes, January 2016.
2016.
We opened.
Okay.
Yes.
So you had a solid 4 years, 16, 17, 18, 19.
Yes, and then when COVID happened, and so March 12th, we had to close because of COVID. We thought, okay, this is going to be 2 weeks, you know, like everyone else. And then because we have a very vibrant Slack. And we organize a lot of things with all the families on Slack. So all our classes just went virtual. And, you know, I think the kids did miss each other, you know, the in-person, the play especially. But obviously this was a pandemic. And then we decided, well, we'll go back the next year part-time, like 2 days a week, and see how that goes. And then we were coming across, like, these people wanted to wear masks, these people didn't want to wear masks. There's going to be a big expense in extra staff and changing out, making outside areas and inside areas. Mm-hmm. And I was getting a lot of people who are like, well, we're just going to take the year off. Or they had, you know, children who were a little compromised. Like, there was, you know, they had a lot of, we have some children who, just didn't want, you know, if you get a COVID in your family, it could be devastating for a family member, put it that way.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I was just thinking, well, I can take a big deep breath and just go for it. but everyone was seemingly they were doing pretty well at home, and they were potting up in their little groups and meeting with their little family sort of groups. And I'm just like, you know, I think everyone, like my son was like, I think they're okay. I don't know if we really need to go back. And you know, I think I got to the point where I'm like, okay, well, I feel like, and by this time, I just have to say that I started this research and development company, and I've been helping people create spaces like this for 2 years.
You've been helping other people create spaces like Workspace.
Like Workspace, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And inspiring them to think about space differently, right? And the biggest obstacle that people have is getting a building or financing a building. And it's very complex when you're dealing with families, not just the students. It just adds this whole level of complexity to the whole operation. And I'd been toying with the idea of, like, when we, you know, like, what would a landscape for families look like if I built one in the sky? You know, like, you're playing Real Player One and it was your perfect environment, what would that look like? And I feel like everyone's, you know, complaining about Zoom Zoom calls and online learning, and everyone's dying to get back into person, into in-person learning. But there were so many advantages to doing online learning, just like, you know, like I could easily get people to come here and do mentoring with the kids, and I can have all these collaborations with all these different organizations. And it's so much less, it's so hard to get everyone to drive into this little place in Bethel, Connecticut to do all this stuff. that I just couldn't give enough to these teens. I didn't feel like at Workspace I could give enough to them. Hmm. Like I wanted to give them everything that they needed that would supplement a homeschooling journey. And I wanted to be a bridge to the real world and get them out doing these amazing projects.
Well, it
just took a lot of energy.
But what you were describing earlier about, like, for example, the Alice in Wonderland sort of spontaneous collaborations and the people in the kitchen inspire other people to do something else. I mean, all of that organic cross-pollination that happens in person when someone can just be upstairs and have an idea and run downstairs and tell their friend downstairs about it. I mean, that you're saying you felt like you couldn't give the students, the teens there enough. It seems like you were already giving them so much and in this very fun dynamic in the flesh environment.
Yes, except, you know, it was expensive because it's expensive to run a building. So like, I really wanted to make it much cheaper. Like the staff was, you know, like 2/3 of your budget, and then buildings the pretty much the rest. But new technology has come out like over the last year where we can now do all those collisions like we do in person, and we can do them in person, virtually, but in person. So you're there, you're running around, you're bumping into someone, their video screen comes on, right?
Yeah, your this is like the website Gather.
Like Gathertown.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've designed a complete, like if you could imagine the best possible learning environment based on all educational theories that you've come across and all that kind of stuff, like that you could put in, what would that look like? Like, so this is what it does. Like when you don't have to actually buy the building, right? And you don't have to work with the space that you've got, which is a huge constraint. You can now use your imagination to think about, oh my gosh, if I really wanted to give a student the world, right? And an understanding of the world, what would that look like? That's what Montessori wanted. She's like, this is what you got to do with teenagers. You got to give them the world. They've got to know about everything, right? And they've got to know it from the big picture all the way, you know, and how it all works. The laws of the universe, story of humans, of technology, of invention, of discovery.
If we could, you know, resurrect Maria Montessori and say, what do you think of the online collaboration? I'm really curious what she would say. I was very taken.
She would love it.
When I read, you know, her notes on the adolescent years and her ideas about like, okay, what these kids do not need right now is traditional classroom learning. What they do need is to go to a farm or a B&B and have some responsibilities, but it's always social. You're doing it with other people. You have these like real world experiences. Maybe you talk about academics a little bit, but it's in a very sort of like problem-oriented way, not just siloed academics. But really, it's a lot of doing and not as much abstract learning that can come again later in the 16 to 20 years. That's my memory of what she said. But it seemed like she really stressed the in-person aspect so much. It's like you're on a farm working with your hands.
Yes, that's right. But in-person stuff, right? Because it's expensive, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to do everything in person, right? Like, because just think of how much, like at school, right? Like what percentage of time do kids spend doing really boring stuff in person?
A lot.
Right? A lot, right? Like, why don't we have these spaces all around the place? Little tiny, little micro labs, little everything, like little really high quality experiences that really grow you as a human. And then you can go anywhere and do boring stuff. You don't have to be in person, right? Right? I'm in Montana in the mountains right now. I could sit here and do a really boring algebra class. My son's, no, I won't say what he's doing right now, but he's doing online learning right now in Montana. But he's also like, you know, he's taking his horse out, and he's, you know, he's learning about regenerative farming and thistles and all sorts of different things, you know, in a really nice physical environment. And I just think we need to mix it up.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you are really passionate about revolutionizing education, do something awesome, like do something transformational that's really high quality, right? And then let's take what you're doing and network it with all these other people who are doing really cool stuff, right?
Listen, I'm totally on board with you, Catherine. I think that, you know, for example, I take teenagers on these international trips or run domestic programs where they come together and have this really intensive experience for somewhere between 4 to 6 weeks. And then they go home back to their normal lives. And and so I see myself as just one small part in this ecosystem, but hopefully a really, you know, positive, impactful one. So I'm totally with you on having all these different little ecosystems and little opportunities, and families get to decide how to piece them all together.
Yeah.
So
So this is this thing I've created now.
Workspace Sky.
Mycelium. Yeah. Workspace Sky Teens, 13 to 18 year olds. It's the mycelium that we have in the cloud. And then from the cloud, they work out all the things that they want to do, the classes, all that kind of stuff. And then they find other people who live near where they are, or they find what they really love to do. And they go down and do that in person in real world experiences. Like they go down and they work in a wood shop, in a community of practice, or, you know, alongside, you know, they do a little apprenticeships, so, and they do, you know, those sort of things.
So let's just stick with this example of like woodwork. Are you saying that the sort of value that Workspace Sky is contributing to a family here is that maybe this family did not even know that this wood shop exists locally, or they didn't know that that the wood shop is open to teenagers coming in and participating. Mm-hmm. And so you are connecting the family with the opportunity locally. And if that's true, do you do that all over the US or even farther? Because that just seems like a whole lot of information that needs to be processed there.
Yeah, no. What we do is we teach, we've collaborated with Dr. Chris Unger at Northeastern. Do you know? You must know.
No. He's awesome. You should tell me and everyone else
and
who
Jim
this
McHugh
is.
Jim McHugh also. he runs the doctoral program in innovation in education. Just really, he's on a mission to revolutionize education, and he finds the best stuff that's happening out there, and he does podcasts and gets the word out about that. Very dedicated individual. But anyway, he's running our mentoring program with Jim McHugh, hopefully. And we're designing a place. He wants to have this really cool house with a big backyard, and the kids come out, walk into his backyard and sit around the fire pit, and they talk. And it's all about just having conversations about how, you know, what do you really care about, and how would you like to go out, and, you know, basically how do you want to design your next part of your pathway that includes that.
But this is an in-person experience in someone's backyard that's only accessible
to... Yeah, it's a virtual backyard.
Oh, it's virtual backyard. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I didn't pick that up.
Yeah. It's it looks like, this is a podcast, but if this was not a podcast, I could actually take you around and we could walk around. I could show you these kinds of locations. Okay. So, you know, we have a Space Age Laws of the Universe Center at the center of our town. It looks a bit like a university campus, and it's filled with different buildings. You can go into galleries to see. Like you walk in and you go into the interior of a building and it's a gallery and it's filled with
it's a whole virtual world, and you have an avatar and you can go and meet people spontaneously. You can go to organized events.
Classes. And you book classes. You just like on a regular catalog, your class is just on a location on the map. Mm-hmm. So, but you have to walk to it and you might bump into someone on the way.
Catherine,
you have an advisory.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the game Second Life? This was a big thing, I think, in the aughts, somewhere in the early 2000s. I remember getting excited at some point about someone had a proposal for a Second Life university. Mm-hmm. And the idea was you have an avatar, you're out there interacting with people.
Like in the MOOC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but MOOCs, you know, that's something we should pay attention to, because there was a lot of hype about MOOCs around 2010, and there was not a lot of substance there.
Yes.
You know, MOOCs were very handy for people from other countries, a lot of people who already had bachelor's degrees, for example. Like they didn't serve the theorized audience as well as everyone hoped they would. They didn't disrupt higher education in any significant way.
No. No, that's right. And this may not either, but what I know about it is that I can provide 10 times as much value through this platform at a tenth of the cost. And I feel like I can, with this platform, be a bridge to the real world. And for any teenager who, you know, for where school is not working, and there are a lot, or you're in hospital, or you're in a remote location, or your parents are moving around a lot, and you just need that consistency of friend group, or you're in a school situation and you've got a really subpar friend group, or you want to find someone who really loves industrial car design and you haven't been able to find one, this could be worth a go to check out whether it's whether it's for you or not.
Can you do it part-time or full-time?
You can, like, it's just like Workspace. So you just get a season pass.
Yeah.
It's a 10-week season or a 3-month season.
Oh.
You can try it. It's $350 a season.
Oh, that is
and
cheap.
And we have, we have speed friending. Like, we have 3 big social events. Speed friending, we've got a big Halloween party. We're doing a Thanksgiving scavenger hunt as our big social events. Mm-hmm. And everybody gets to be part of an advisory. We have 16 staff members who are putting this together. Mm-hmm. And our theme for the first season is belonging, based on the book Belong by Radha Agrawal, which is an amazing thing about, how do you look into yourself, find out how you want to put yourself out there, and then how do you choose friends, like based on your values, your character, and who you want to be hanging out with.
Classic questions for teenagers.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing. And the second theme in our winter season is going to be on soft skills, the soft skills that we need to, communicate, but really get to the next lily pad in the journey. And complementing this, I'm sorry to butting in and talking your ear off, but we've got a very exciting coaching platform for them too, based on what we learned from Workspace and Dream Directing. And that is really to support their, each learner, if they want it. This is it's additional. It's $290 for a season to have a coach. We have one-to-one coaching for these kids to help them. It's to help them wayfind, to design their best life or their educational journey, or to start a project from soup to nuts.
I mean, if you have both of those, the membership and the coaching, that's still less than $700 for
a season. Yeah, it's very, very inexpensive. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So I think, I feel like that it's an affordable option, so it's worth giving it a go. We even have a $200 discount if you sign up for the year or 3 seasons.
And we're recording this right now in summer of 2021. And I mean, is this good to go? Is this happening already? Is it starting this fall?
Yeah, it's September 7th is our first day.
September 7th.
Yeah, so we're about to launch. I mean, this has been in my head for a little while, but we started with the concept artist and digital design team in March. So is it going to be 100% complete? Well, it will be with all the concept drawings. So we will be able to run around the concept drawings if we haven't quite finished the digitalization. But I'm hoping we'll get some teens also to jump in. They've been designing dorm rooms. Our teen focus group has been they've been designing lockers. We've got these portals. We have lockers, and you can go in your own portal that goes into your own dorm room. So
that's
all these
pretty cool
things that we're doing.
So you're going to be reliant upon some teens to swing some digital hammers onto some digital nails and maybe help build the place out.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, why wouldn't you want to do that? I want them to start their own government. I mean, like, they can do, this is their world, right?
Yeah.
And our team is designed to listen to them. And then we are adapting to the Generation Zers that we're going to be attracting.
So let's talk about the classic concern for parents, which is, if my kid does this full time, is my kid meeting academic standards? Are they staying on track somehow? How do you respond to those kinds of questions?
Well, so we are not the actual education providers. We partner with education providers. Mm-hmm. So we are the container in which the education can happen at the level of participation that the parent or the teen wants to participate. depending on the family and the child and the philosophy and the worldview, right, they're going to have a different way. Like every single child is different, right? And they're going to be at a different spot in their academics in different areas. We have a parent community in a Mighty Network. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mighty Networks. It's a fairly new platform. We have two staff members dedicated to our parents and helping them create and support their teen on a self-directed journey.
Just to be specific, like if a kid says, mm-hmm. I want to take algebra, mm-hmm. does Workspace Sky help connect that kid to some algebra provider? I'm imagining yes. that you're not providing this directly. You don't say like, we're hiring an algebra teacher and you can come to the algebra class.
No, but we partner with like Arizona State University, their digital prep program. And they have over 40 classes, high school classes, but they also do dual enrollment classes. And I mean, that's just one. There's plenty of different ones. And we also have a curriculum specialist if parents want to, you know, get more information.
So fundamentally, this is a social network for teens.
Yeah, social learning network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so beyond the socialization aspect, the amount of traditional academics or other kinds of formal learning that someone may want to do is up to them.
Is absolutely up to them. Yeah. So they could do no curriculum, like they could be absolutely unschooled and it could just be part of their life, right? Yeah. A way to have a consistent friend group and to find friends in
Glad
things
that
they're passionate about it.
Yeah.
Yes. And then on the other hand, you know, I think you have actually time to do both. I think you can do a very challenging course. You could do community college classes. You could do, like my daughter did her high school at our local university. You can challenge yourself, right? Like every child can challenge themselves. And, you know, we'll talk about that in coaching and design, you know, their best academic pathway. And you know, you could be working in your advisory, you're going to have unschooled students, learners, people. you're going to have very traditionally schooled people. You could still be at school and be a member. There's no reason why you couldn't be. But we're not focusing on academics. We're focusing on being good humans and, you know, building character and value and finding out what we need or what they need to be doing in the world to be successful and fulfilled and happy and contributing.
How many teens do you want to have in this, let's say by the end of the first year? What do you imagine?
My dream would be to have 200. We can have up to 500.
Okay. But what's the limit? Why no more than 500?
Oh, well, on this platform, you know, I run a nonprofit, right? It's a research and development company.
100
words. I'm putting this out there. Yes. I'm putting this out there because I want people to make it for their communities, right? It's not rocket science to build one of these things. It, you know, takes dedication and time, but you can make something that's completely adaptable to you, to your community, right? And it really doesn't take very long. I mean, I'm doing something elaborate because I can't help myself. And I also want to show the world what is possible and help them imagine and not be limited by that, the space thing, because all the founders, or most of the founders that come to work with 100 Roads, they're like, well, I really need to get a building, right? And I see the building as limiting, you know, what they really want, right, is to transform education and transform the experience that these teens are having so that these teens are, you know, are really going to unlock their potential. And so I don't think it happens in the building.
Well, I want to challenge you on that because I'm imagining teens that I've known for whom homeschooling has been a rather isolating experience. Mm-hmm. And when they go to a place where they're meeting other people in person, and I, of course, think of not back to school camp, you know, this is a totally radical transformation, positively, you know, radical transformation in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are a lot of teens who really do want a group.
Yeah.
Like their primary need is a face-to-face social group of other teens to hang out with. There are unschoolers who go back to school just so they can have access to other teens.
No, a lot of them do. I mean, that's the biggest excuse. People put up with a lot to have a consistent friend group.
A physical, consistent friend group.
Yeah, that's right. They'll put up with being in a really harmful situation. For that, yes.
So if you have a kid like that who's coming to Workspace Sky and says, listen, this is great. I'm making some cool friends online, but I'm just, I really need to hang out with someone face-to-face who I can like give a hug to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and they should, right? So that's fantastic. If someone says that, I'll be like, right, so who are you looking for, right? Like, what would be that perfect person? Like, and what would you be doing if you were together? Oh, you would be in theater. Have you thought about maybe looking at checking out all the local theaters in your area?
So you'd point them towards extracurricular type programs.
Well, I would say, like, I'd really find out what is their fun, what are they really feeling? I'd help them examine what is that void that they're missing. And I don't see why they can't do their theater program and get that camaraderie, that feeling of belonging and family there. And then, you know, also be in the sky and, you know, and choosing classes and getting to know other people. If they might find that, well, they don't need Workspace Guy. They've got their theater group, and that is perfectly fine too. We're not trying to be a perfect fit for everybody. Mm-hmm. We just want to be a place that people can go and, you know, find other people and get connected to learning and experiences that they just didn't get connected to when they were at home, like, you know, career exploration, big ideas. Like, we've got a whole talk series on sustainability, on social justice. We've got different people who are actually moving into our town centre and having a building and offering different, you know, classes and courses for the teens.
Will there be a chance for Workspace Sky teens to meet each other at some sort of event that's, you know, perhaps organized or sponsored by Workspace? A gathering.
That's what's happening all the time. It's in Gather. So it's 12 hours a day. We're open.
No, I mean, physically, face to face.
Physically, yes.
I made a friend in Workspace Sky that's in New York. I live in Southern California. How do I meet them beyond just doing you know, a personal, you know, travel to get there? How can we hang out with all 12 of our favorite friends?
Yeah. So we're thinking of hitting you up, Blake.
Oh, really?
To joining Workspace Sky teens. And
You're pitching me on my podcast. I like this. This is very bold.
Maybe you could have your own building and you could be the incredible experiences. I'm not sure what you call your amazing experiences.
Or even just like a retreat for a week, right?
Yeah. But like, you know, I'm on a ranch in Montana and I could easily have, you know, groups of teens that come here. We have 17 horses. We could go fly fishing. We could do all these different things and have these experiences. And, you know, I really don't see it. We had let me give you an example. We had Thane Richard, who came last week, who's an amazing educator, who during COVID bought a sailing ship called the Rose. And his dream was to circumnavigate the world and to teach kids. He teaches at Proctor and a, you know, bunch of different places. Teach kids how to actually circumnavigate the world.
Well, that's cool.
And you know, we could actually design his ship on the platform that people can actually go inside the ship, right? And do lessons.
A virtual replica of the ship.
Yeah, of the Rose. We could put into the landscape. And then, you know, you could do the 10-week session, let's say, where you're learning how to use the astrolabe, isn't it?
Astrolabe.
All the navigational tools. And then you could go, you know, if you could, to the in-person experience. But, you know, obviously not everyone can afford the, you know, in-person experiences.
Yes, of course. Travel is expensive.
So we don't want to limit those people who, you know, we want them to be able to partake as much as they can as well. And get exposure to that.
Yeah, and for the record, I'm very excited about everything you're describing here. And I have thought about creating similar things in my own life. And I think that just even the promise of like this virtual community, meeting face to face, even if it's just once a year, or even just like the entire time that you are part of Workspace Sky, even if there's just one time you can look forward to actually meet these other people. I just imagine that to be so motivating for these teens as compared to 100% virtual programs that have no game plan for meeting face to face.
Yeah. Well, I know that Stanford University does that. And I remember students being very excited about going to their 2 weeks.
Their online high school?
Yeah, with their online high school, they had a 2-week gathering in the summer. But you know, we haven't put any programming in the summer yet for that reason. And we've been, I just moved to Montana, so like we're just unpacking still. You know, I'd love to connect with other people who do really great, deep in-person things, right? Mm-hmm. And offer them like the most amazing summer, right? I don't have to be doing that part of it. I'd much prefer for people who are really specialized.
You can outsource that.
To outsource that to really amazing stuff. So I'd like to vet it, to find out the best stuff in the country and then offer it to the teens so they can participate and meet each other in that way.
Great. Well, I imagine after this podcast airs, you'll have a number of parents fervently typing in Workspace Sky Teens. What's the website just for reference?
Well, it's just, we're still we haven't launched it yet. Oh. I mean, it's coming soon. It's worksky.org is our website.
Worksky.org.
Yeah, but you could, I'm sure if you Googled it, things
We'll put
Workspace
a link
Education.
In the notes for this episode too.
Yeah. Or 100 Roads as well. Notoriously bad at the self-promotion. So,
okay, we're working on it right now. This exposure therapy.
So any help there would be amazing. but also, like, I'm really interested in people who want to participate because, you know, it's really fun to do this with other people. And it's really great to connect us all the people are doing neat stuff. And I want to promote everybody else.
Well, I think, you know, your whole vision and your whole story, Catherine, is really inspiring. And I love it when I see the sort of serial entrepreneurs in this realm. You try one thing and then try another thing and then try the next thing. And sort of like the Liberated Learners Network or the ALC Network, you are also helping other people to create their own versions of this in their own area. And I love the price point on Workspace Sky just because it's very different. It's a whole order of magnitude lower than most other online offerings today. So that's excellent.
And as teens don't drive, do you remember that time when you couldn't drive yet and you just felt stuck and you had to ask your mom to drive you places?
Yeah.
These are the teens I'm targeting. I really want them to have a place so they can actually go and meet other people without leaving the house too. Mm.
Well, hopefully leaving the house every once in a while, right?
Well, yes. No, absolutely. But to high quality things, not for the boring stuff.
Okay. I like it. All right. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.